So a lot of the songs, the Tea Party, Mad as Hell, Battle of the Rush Limbaugh, you know, I could not not write something. Yes.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Tasmania's upper house narrowly nixes a marriage proposal, a U.S. appeals court hears a lesbian widow's DOMA appeal, and the mutatis mutandis of Nona Hendricks. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 29th, 2012. Tasmania's Legislative Assembly, the Australian state's upper house, has defeated a bill to open civil marriage to same-gender couples by an 8-vote majority in the 15-member chamber. It had passed in the lower house in August. During 2 days of emotional debate, prior to the September 27th vote in the upper house, some of the bill's opponents said they wanted to maintain what they called the traditional definition of marriage as being between one man and one woman. Others said they were concerned about the legal costs for Tasmanian taxpayers to inevitably defend the measure in the High Court because it would conflict with federal law that defines marriage as exclusively heterosexual. But Tasmanian Premier Laura Giddings, a strong supporter of the bill, said that her government would not give up on reform. "It's not the end, it's the beginning," she said. Greens leader Nick McKim charged that the council's chosen fear over love, division over unity, and the 19th century over the 21st century. And venerable activist Rodney Croom pointed to the rapid progress for LGBT people in a state that was the last in the country to decriminalize gay sex. "In Tasmania, we've come closer to allowing same-sex couples to marry than ever before in Australia's history," he said. If opponents of this bill think they have put the debate to bed, they are wrong. The loss in the island state's legislative assembly follows the defeat of a federal marriage equality bill in both houses of the Australian Parliament last week.
The Obama administration officially declared this week that binational same-gender couples living in the U.S. would be viewed as families in immigration proceedings. Unlike heterosexual couples, American gays and lesbians cannot sponsor their foreign-born partners for legal residency, so the move comes as a relief to many same-gender binational couples that have been living under the threat of the foreign national's deportation. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano issued a memo last year saying that the immigrants who were facing deportation could be considered low priority by prosecutors if certain factors were present, including having close family ties in the United States. Government officials had said informally that lesbian and gay couples would be included in that definition. But in a September 27th letter responding to a request for clarification of the policy by Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and 83 other House Democrats, Napolitano wrote that she was directing Immigration and Customs Enforcement to disseminate written guidance to the field that the interpretation of the phrase family relationships includes long-term same-sex partners. Jennifer Chrysler of the Family Equality Council called it incredible news for the 36,000 binational same-sex couples in the U.S., nearly half of whom are raising children. Rachel D. Tiven of Immigration Equality also celebrated the move. "Until now, LGBT families and their lawyers had nothing to rely on but an oral promise that prosecutorial discretion would include all families," she wrote. "Today, DHS has made that promise real. Now the courts and Congress should act to make relief permanent and provide access to green cards for all LGBT families." A bill to do just that, called the Reuniting Families Act, has been introduced in Congress, but it won't see the light of day as long as Republicans maintain their majority in the House.
A panel of judges for the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments in New York this week in the case of 83-year-old lesbian widow Edith Windsor, who's challenging the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. She was forced to pay more than $363,000 in estate taxes upon the death of her longtime partner, Thea Speier, in 2009. The couple's legal 2007 marriage in Canada was recognized by the state of New York, but a key provision of DOMA bans any recognition of legally married same-gender couples by the federal government. Windsor told The Advocate that she would have to pay no taxes at all if Thea had been Theo.
The appeals court judges focused on the question of which level of judicial scrutiny applies in this case. Laws based on race are subjected to what's called strict scrutiny, where the government needs to show that the law in question must be narrowly tailored to meet a compelling interest. For laws based on gender, the court subjects them to intermediate scrutiny, where the government must show that an important interest of the state is advanced by the law. If the classification isn't within one of those areas of heightened scrutiny, then the government just needs to show a legitimate or rational basis for the law. Windsor's American Civil Liberties Union legal team, led by attorney Roberta Kaplan, argued that the constitutionality of DOMA should be considered under the highest standard of strict scrutiny. She added, however, that the law would not even pass the least stringent test of rational basis review, calling DOMA an unprecedented, permanent, one-time exception for gay people.
Speaker John Boehner's Republican House majority stepped in to defend DOMA in federal court early last year after the Obama administration announced that it would no longer do so, having concluded that the law is indeed unconstitutional. Heavyweight D.C. Attorney Paul Clement argued for House Republicans during this week's Second Circuit hearing that lesbians and gay men are not politically powerless because they can get the attention of legislatures, as they did with the passage of last year's marriage equality bill in New York. He said their vulnerability couldn't be compared with African Americans and women, who were, at one time, denied the fundamental right to vote. Clement said he was not aware of any situation of political disenfranchisement that was based on sexual orientation.
Several district courts have already declared DOMA unconstitutional. In May, the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston became the first appellate-level federal court to rule that the 1996 statute violates the U.S. Constitution. Windsor, who's in failing health, had already asked the U.S. Supreme Court to expedite her case. The High Court is widely expected to hear one or more cases involving marriage rights during its upcoming term. If Windsor's isn't one of them, the Second Circuit will eventually issue its verdict. Windsor told reporters outside the courthouse following the hearing that, "I look forward to the day when the federal government recognizes all marriages as legal, and I'm very hopeful that the day will come while I'm still alive."
In other news, some of the usual suspects issued their latest anti-gay pronouncements this week. Notoriously homophobic Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who once claimed that there are no gay people in his country, was in New York this week for the United Nations General Assembly. He told Piers Morgan during an interview on CNN that homosexuality is very ugly behavior that has been forbidden by all prophets and all religions and all faiths. When asked if LGBT people had any human rights, he said that homosexuality ceases procreation. Who has said that if you like or believe in doing something ugly and others do not accept your behavior, that they're denying your freedom? If a group recognizes an ugly behavior or ugly deed as legitimate, he added, you must not expect other countries or other groups to give it the same recognition.
Roman Catholic Pope Benedict XVI told 32 French bishops this week that the traditional definition of marriage must be promoted and defended. The government of France's recently elected socialist president François Hollande has said that it would fulfill a campaign promise by introducing a bill in Parliament in October to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Benedict said that the Church must promote those values that permit the full development of the human person. They include defending life and the family, which he said is threatened in many places by a faulty conception of human nature.
Meanwhile, Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, who's the Vatican's permanent observer to the United Nations in Geneva, complained to the body's Human Rights Council this week that people who criticize same-gender love are increasingly being persecuted for their views. He said that the Roman Catholic Church deeply believes that human sexuality is a gift reserved for married heterosexual couples, and that its proponents are being attacked and vilified for expressing their beliefs. Tomasi told the council in 2009 that the vast majority of Roman Catholic clergy who had molested children were not pedophiles but homosexuals, who were sexually attracted to adolescent males.
And finally, Vitaly Milonov, a city councilor in St. Petersburg, said this week that homosexuality is just a bad habit that can be eliminated by fasting and prayer. Milonov wrote the so-called No Promo Homo law in Russia's second-largest city that criminalizes the promotion of homosexuality to minors. The law essentially bans any public advocacy for LGBT rights, including pride events. I do not know of a single case within the Russian Orthodox Church that a man would not be cured by his sincere repentance in this sin, Milonov said. People get rid of it just like they get rid of kleptomania or, for instance, fornicators.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 29th, 2012. follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep This Way Out on the air at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Abby Dees.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson. I play Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others. So if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
When troubling political times meet enduring musical talent, surprising things can happen. Although no one should really be surprised that Nona Hendrix is back with a new album, even though it's been 20 years since her last. The legendary lesbian singer-songwriter and founding member of Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells was a recent guest on Resonance FM's Out in South London with Rosie Wilby to talk about the changing times and musical styles she's been a part of, including her latest metamorphosis.
The Tea Party. T stands for Trouble Party. The Tea Party.
The Tea Party.
The Me Party.
The Me Party.
The Tea Party.
The Tea Party.
It's all about me party.
The Me Party.
The Tea Party.
The Tea Party.
The Me Party.
The Me Party.
They said he can't be a he or she a he party. The No Party.
The No Party.
The Hell No Party.
The Hell No Party.
But don't you know that there's a hell below party? The Steel Party. Shoot to kill part. I said, brother, can you be for real part? Don't play the fool. The castration of a nation on the radio and TV stations. They say they want to take their country back, but don't they know it wasn't theirs, and that's a fact. The Tea Party. Talk about the Tea Party.
The Tea Party.
The Tea Party. It's all about me part.
The Me Party.
The Tea Party.
The Tea Party.
The Old Party.
The Old Party.
The Tea Party.
The Tea Party.
They want control part.
Control part.
I said, don't they know there's a hell below part? The Tea Party.
The Tea Party.
The Me Party.
The Me Party.
They said she can speak English as good as me part. The Old Party.
I hope I'm saying right.
No, you're saying it right.
Yeah.
Some people have messed it up.
And it starts with a wonderfully scathing song about the Tea Party, which perhaps gives a hint as to where your energy came from about making your first record in many years. Tell us
yes.
a bit about
it. Came that. Out of the, you know, it's been about 12 years in brewing, and I actually was nudged by a fan who's got in touch with me by email and said, "You realize you haven't made a record in 20 years?" I looked and I went, "Oh, no, I haven't." And then I thought about that, and then I looked at, I don't know which artist it was, but I looked at an artist and I saw that they were constantly putting things out. And it was also kind of, I stepped away because also the music business was going through such drastic changes. There was hip-hop and there was pop, and I wasn't hip-hop and I wasn't pop. And so my music, wasn't sure where it would fit within the landscape of the music business. But with this nudge from someone, I began to look at what I'd been writing over time, and I'd been affected by the many things that had been happening in America, from the attack on the Twin Towers and 9/11, and then America becoming really polarized by the act of going to war and invading another country, and, you know, the things that, how America began to become this country that other countries or people began to hate. going from what was considered a country that was democratic and spreading this, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of this, freedom of, you know, and also looking within the way America responded to its own disaster in Katrina,
yeah,
in New Orleans, and just really did not respond to help people there, and mainly because they were people of color. Mm. I don't think it would have happened that way otherwise. And then the rise of the bigotry and hatred out of America that was obviously hidden, most of it, when Barack Obama started to run for president. And just so many things that I thought we had grown out of and changed came back and almost was shocking to me. And so a lot of the songs, the Tea Party, Mad as Hell, Battle of Rush Limbaugh, you know, I could not write something.
Yes. And the actual title, Mutatis Mutandis, in Latin, it's sort of...
Changing those things which need to be changed.
Yes, and but not making any
major
more
changes.
Major,
yes.
Deeper, resonant changes that we perhaps need as well. And it's coming out on Righteous Babe as well, which seems to be a good home for it, because the music business is not necessarily always on the lookout for albums that actually is saying something political.
No, they haven't been for quite a few years. Mm. I mean, if those that do come out are either on small labels like Righteous Babe and, you know, not the sort of obvious pop, grist-for-the-mill kind of music. Toshi Reagan, who's a friend of mine, actually introduced me to Ani. So this is how that happened.
Mm. And sort of let's go back a little bit in time to your sort of early beginnings in the 60s when you're singing with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells.
Yes.
So many girl groups around at the time. What was the whole scene like? Was there any rivalry or camaraderie? Yeah. Who did you get on with?
Well, I think we got on well with most of the other girl groups. But yes, there was rivalry. We were just like, you know, what kind of wigs are they wearing? Because everybody was wearing wigs. And, you know, we couldn't have the same... You couldn't be on the show and have the same kind of gowns on. Especially if they were... You couldn't wear white. If they were wearing white, you had to wear another color. And also the songs. I mean, we were a lot of... The different girl groups were doing... You had to find a big ballad that you could do that was your big number in your show. So you had to not sing the song that everybody else was singing. And, you know, Martha and Vandellas, we were good friends with Martha and Mary from the Supremes, Gladys of the Marvelettes, and Ronnie and I've known Ronnie for years.
Ronnie Spector
from the Ronettes. God, there were so many that you had to be competitive. But when you're on the show with different groups for a week at a time, doing, you know, 3 and 4, sometimes even 5 shows a day, you get to know each other pretty well, and you do things, you know, like talk about clothes, where to go shopping, and, you know.
And then when
boyfriends, girlfriends, not girlfriends so much, boyfriends. Yes.
But then when you did, when that did break up, you became LaBelle. There was quite an image change. So tell us a little bit about the changing image.
Well, that was, you know, 1969, 70, going from, you know, the post Haight Ashbury flower power, painting flowers on, you know, on your face, and dashikis and tie dye and things like that. And we went from being, you know, wearing wigs and nice gowns and gloves and singing oohs and ahs to afros, dressing more like a rock band and really performing more like a rock band. We, you know, we had guitars and we were doing songs by The Who and The Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. And we met this group of guys who became our sort of fan club of following gay guys, Larry Legaspi, Richard Erker, Tony, and they just said, you know, we want to dress you, we want to make things for you. And Larry specifically was the main designer, and he was into making cabling space-type clothing.
Wow.
And he designed, told us to ask us to come by his store, which was called Moonstone. It was a moonscape, and he had these amazing things that he was making that we went and we saw, and we went like, those are amazing, yes. And he started designing them for us, and that's where that came from. And not long after that, we had the hit with Voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir, and that sort of we did that whole Wear Something Silver tour, and people came to the Metropolitan Opera House, and they were just people who had silver carriages, and, you know, they painted horses silver.
Wow.
And nuns dressed in silver, and, you know, it was just an amazing night.
You spent some time over in London then, didn't
yes,
you,
we
over
did.
In the UK.
And yes.
What was the scene like here then?
It was actually great. I mean, we had a great time. It was kind of at the end of the British invasion in Carnaby Street, and that had already happened. This was in 1969. But it was really a good time because it was pre-people with their entourage of security guards and things like that, and it was also pre-going into, you know, punk happened much later. Mm. So there was this restless period, but restless in a way that people could make music however they wanted to. Everybody was working with everybody.
Yeah. No boundaries. Almost.
Yeah.
And one group that you supported at the time, you did some support tour with The Who, is that right?
Yeah, we
How
did.
Was that?
Well, we were on the same label, on Track Records, and Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp signed us to the label. They managed The Who and Jimi Hendrix. And The Who were going to America to do a tour, and they, you know, said, well, we want the girls to open for The Who, which is like, that may not be the right idea. But it worked. It was great. I mean, you know, playing to an audience that we were like, well, we're not sure how they're going to accept us. And we weren't even sure of what we were yet, because we were just finding, by performing and recording, what eventually became LaBelle. I mean, we were in that period of discovering and playing with music. But it was great. I mean, the audience, they were primarily young, white, rock kids, you know, and here we come out, these three black girls, not in your traditional sort of party dresses, and we weren't looking like the Ronettes. We were looking like kind of like a British boy band. But they were great. I mean, once we started singing, doing Wild Horses, you know, there was music that they could identify with coming from people that they probably did not so much identify with. And it was an interesting mixture.
And we talked a bit about how, you know, in the 70s you sort of became more of this sort of space age kind of group, and obviously your big hit that you had around that time, Lady Marmalade. Did you have any idea how successful that might be?
None whatsoever. We were really going to make a new album, and we somehow, for some reason, we went to LA, and I can't even remember why we went to LA. And Bob Crewe lived there, and Bob Crewe was a bro building songwriter, and he is, you know, because he's still alive. And we went to visit Bob because Vicky Wickham, who managed LaBelle, knew Bob, and he said, come over, and we was just staying up the road from him in the hotel. And we went, and of course, you're a brill building writer, here's a group sitting in front of you, you're going to get out your songs and go, you know, try this one on. And he did. He just started playing these different songs on the piano that he was writing or writing with other people, and we were like, no, not that. And then he played Uliva Kushava Glossa Swan, and that was like, basically we went, what are you singing? What does that mean? Because none of us spoke French. And he's, you know, explained it to us, and Vicky did speak French, as she knew. And we were like, wow, that's great, because it was a great hope. And we were going to New Orleans, so we connected with the fact that, you know, she was a woman of the night in New Orleans. And so we recorded it, and then history. Oh, drastically. I mean, up until that point, you know, we'd had success. And really, we'd come back and forth to Europe over the years performing, but we didn't. This took us to, you know, playing, I guess, what, arenas or stadiums as opposed to playing theaters and clubs, which is what we've been doing for the... I think we've played some stadiums because we opened for the Rolling Stones when they first toured America.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a following from there.
A bit of a taste of that. Yeah. Yes.
And and also opening for James Brown over time. So we'd had that happen, but we didn't really have it on our own where we could.
In your own right.
Yeah. Yes. So that changed. And it changed. I think you gain a certain amount of confidence in terms of that you have an audience that is listening for what you have to say in a different way than they did before.
Right.
And that changed. And I don't know. I think people also began to see us as more... I think we became unique in music history.
Absolutely.
Which was... We didn't know that we were making history. You know, you see it in hindsight, but that's what I think people... You know, so many people have said to me and to us over years that, you know, they turned and they went to watch television and... There were these three black women coming out of the ceiling dressed in feathers, and they were like, what is that?
Wow.
And that we basically changed their lives.
The castration of a nation. On the web, they can see you hating. They see the bigotry that you spew. They see the shame you bring the red, white, talking about the teapot,
the meatball,
the teapot. It's all about me, but who said the teapot?
The
old part,
the
old part. Don't you know? Don't you know? Don't you know?
That's Tea Party from the new Nona Hendricks album, Mutatis Mutandis. Hendricks currently lives in New York with her partner, Vicky Wickham. That conversation with Rosie Wilby was produced with Sabine Sherrick for Resonance FM's Out in South London. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Abby Dees, Rick Watts, and Rosie Wilby with Sabine Sherrick contributed program material. Thanks also to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by grants from the Yavanna Foundation and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and by our generous listener supporters. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to listen to our podcasts and link to our blog and Facebook fan page. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email TWORadio@AOL.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening. I'm 2BLU Katoomba, New South Wales, KXCI Tucson, Arizona, WXOJ Northampton, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.